When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
This week's episode of the Elise Glink Show. I'm Elise Glink. I'm here to help you make really smart decisions about your financial life. So as I always do, I want to start with Glinkonomics, which is a word or two about the economy, what I learned this week, and what I think you need to know. So this past week, I was the chair of the Society of American Business Editors and Writers annual conference, and it was held here in my hometown of Chicago. I'm a huge Chicago booster, and I'm really proud that we were able to have other Chicago residents like Secretary of Commerce Penny Pritzker, and we had Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel, and yes, the new governor of Illinois, who unfortunately didn't want to take questions from us, but did give us a whole lot of look at what's going on right now, Governor Bruce Rauner, with the finances of the state. Here's the short line on that. The state of Illinois is broke. We rank 50 out of 50 for a whole bunch of things. Hopefully that will improve under Rauner. The conference kicked off with a really amazing event at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business. And we had Austin Goolsbee, who was one of the economic advisors, chief economic advisor, I think, to Clinton. President Obama. He's not that old. He's now at the University of Chicago, and he travels the world looking at money in the economy. We also had Randall Krosner. Randall used to be part of the Fed, and he also is now at Booth. And just the two of them together offered an amazing perspective of what's going on right now. And so the highlights are that, as we keep saying week after week, mortgage interest rates, the whole interest rates being held at near zero by the Fed, is not a really great sign for the economy. Now, Austin Goolsbee says, well, listen, we've had the best 5 years of job creation that we may have ever had in this country. But on the other hand, a lot of those jobs really aren't paying much more than the minimum wage. And yes, the minimum wage is going up, but it's not going up fast enough for all of the debt that students are graduating with, and there's plenty of that going on. And it's also not enough to let a lot of people back into the housing market. Now, Randy Krosner, you know, who takes a little bit of a different perspective from the Fed, you know, he's looking at how the rest of the world has been dropping their interest rates as well. And actually, if you look at Europe, and particularly Switzerland, right, if you put $100 into a bank in Switzerland, you're going to take out maybe $99. You put $100 into a bank in the U.S., you're going to take out $100 and change. Now, I'm not saying you're going to take out $150 because interest rates are still super low. But what I'm getting at is that there are many places around the world right now which have negative interest rates, effectively negative interest rates. You're putting your money there because it's safer, but you're losing money with every dollar. In the U.S., you may not be making much, right, but you're making something. You're not losing money. And that is profoundly affecting what is going on with interest rates because bond traders, which are driving interest rates, everybody's flocking to the U.S. because they're at least making a few cents on the dollar rather than losing money. That's going to be something to watch going forward. The other thing, going just back to what Austin Goolsbee was saying about jobs, you've got to watch the U6. So the U6 is what I think of and what many economists think of. I'm not an economist. I just play one on here on the video and on radio. But what I think of as an armchair economist is the larger look, the more complete look at unemployment in this country. So the official unemployment rate has dropped way down into the low 5% range, and that's pretty good. The labor participation rate, the number of people who are actually participating in the labor markets, is also super low. And that number is, you know, Austin Goolsbee and Randy Krosner were saying, well, it's going to get lower because the population overall is growing. But it's also lower because a lot of people have just sort of opted out of the marketplace. And here's how I know that. The spread between the official unemployment rate and the U6 is usually just a couple of percentage points. And right now, it's like 5, 6, 7%. It's really a big difference. So we're at a low 5% for the official. We're at 11% plus, closing in on 12% for the U6. That is a 6 to 7% swing. It's a lot more than it should be. You know that we're really getting numbers back to where they want to be when we're at 5.3%, let's say, for the unemployment rate, the official unemployment rate, and only maybe 7 or 8% for the U6. We're not there yet. Keep your eye focused on that ball. It's very telling. Okay, let's get on with the rest of today's show. I've got four great guests for me this week, and then I'm going to answer one of your questions that came in over the transom. First, I'm going to discuss investing in notes with Joel Cohn. Joel is a freelance real estate and business journalist. He writes for U.S. News and World Reports. He blogs for a variety of other publications, and he's just getting started buying notes. And he's looking at mortgages, and he's going to a lot of classes, and I want to jump in with him and find out how that's going. And then we'll check back with him in a couple of months as he's getting ready to buy his first note. Next, I'll be talking with Steve Ely. He is CEO of eCredible. eCredible, which, just to be perfectly open and transparent about it, I sit on a board of advisors for them. I've been an investor in this company. They use alternate types of financial data to create credit reports. This is a super important topic right now because of how tight lending standards are, excluding a lot of qualified homebuyers, particularly first-time homebuyers, young homebuyers who don't have established credit histories, and this prevents them from getting loans. Next up, Nino Sicinava. She is from the home remodeling and design platform Houzz, H-O-U-Z-Z. Nino and I will be discussing Houzz's new quarterly report on how home remodeling and renovation businesses are faring in the first quarter of 2015, what they expect for the current quarter, and what you can expect going on through the rest of the year. Last, I'm going to talk to another private money lender. He's a CEO. His name is Michael Slavin. He's not only the CEO, but he's also the founder of a company called Privlo, or Privlo, which is like private lending, right? Privlo, which is currently expanding its lending operations in Illinois, where I'm based. Privlo is a little different from Vizio Financial Services, which we profiled last week, and that Privlo is gearing its lending toward owner-occupiers rather than investors, particularly those who are self-employed and therefore have a really tough time qualifying for traditional mortgages. Okay, that's this week's lineup, so let's jump in and get started. So I got a comment recently on Twitter from a viewer who wanted me to talk about investing in notes, which can be a very useful real estate investing strategy, right? Particularly when large numbers of loans are in default. Real estate notes, paper, debt, it's all good stuff, but you got to really understand it. So regardless of what you call these things, I'm talking about buying mortgages from a bank or other financial institution so that in most cases, you actually own the lien on a piece of property when you buy the note. So there are, of course, advantages, and then there are disadvantages, risks and rewards to investing in notes. So I invited real estate blogger Joel Cohn, who's written about investing in notes for U.S. News and World Report, to come back on the show to share what he's learned. Since his last visit, he attended some note investing seminars and is investing in notes himself, which is perfect. Hey, Joel, welcome back to Big Money Real Estate.
Thanks, Elise. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. You?
Okay, I'm just getting started. I'm a newbie investor in the note market, so I'm going to these seminars and so forth to learn so that I'm educated in it before, like anything else, before I get started in it. I don't want to be putting my money out there without knowing exactly what I'm doing and networking with other investors who are doing the same thing.
One of the things that I think is really interesting is that you're actually teaching yourself and going through this process, and I always believe that if you can't turn around and tell a 10-year-old how to invest in what you're trying to invest in, you don't understand it nearly well enough to begin to do this. So how is it that you decided to buy notes, to begin buying notes, and where are you beginning the process? Where should other people begin?
Well, I started investing in rental properties for a while, and dealing with the brick and mortar real estate is difficult at times, and now that I'm working from home, I like the idea of working out of my home and not having to do a lot of travel. So I looked around went to my investing group. I asked people, talked to people, listened to different speakers when I was going to real estate and investing expos and things of that sort. And notes seemed to be attractive to me. So because it's something that you can do from home, and you can basically invest in all over the country. But like anything else, you really need to be educated up front.
How do you know what's a good note and a bad note?
Well, you have to do your homework. Like with any investing, you have to do due diligence. And it's can be a little more complicated with notes because you are the bank and you want to make sure that when you buy the notes, you want to make sure that you take a look at all the financials. You look at all the everything from the property condition to tax liens. There's a laundry list of things that you have to do in due diligence in order to do your homework before you decide whether a note is worth investing in or not. There are high cost notes. There are what they call low value notes, depending on the market you're in. So you really need to spend time. Have real things like realtors doing drive-bys for you, shooting pictures for you. You go on the internet, you can look at properties from the outside using Google and so forth. But it's nothing quite like having boots on the ground, actually looking at the property. There's so many different things here to go through.
So you're acting as, just to be really clear, the bank in the transaction. So a buyer would come to you, or the buyer would get a mortgage and then you're going to buy that mortgage from the lender. Where are you actually providing value?
Well, right now I'm just starting out. I'm not doing any of that yet, but what I am doing is I'm taking going through a mentor program with a very experienced investor and learning about these things. Now there's two ways to invest in notes. You can be a passive investor or you can be an active investor. If you want to be a passive investor, then basically you find somebody who has notes to invest in and you put your money up and do a joint venture with them and sit back and hopefully it pays off in the end and you either get share in the rent money that's coming in if you get the note reperforming, or you when it sells, you share 50-50 in the profit made from the sale of the home afterwards if you have to go to foreclosure. Being an active investor means you're actually going out, you're going to banks, hedge funds, private equity firms, and actively seeking out the notes yourself, doing the due diligence, making the offer to buy the note, and then you have a servicer to service the note. If the property is out of state, you're going to probably have a realtor in that city that can take a look at it. You get property management. There's a lot of other factors that go into investing in notes. It's not just okay. Let's find a note and buy it and see and collect the money at the end of it.
What is your ROI perspective? What are you thinking about when interest rates are so low? Truly, it's higher than what you can get putting your money in savings, but there is a risk reward assessment that you have to make. So,
sure.
What is that for you, and what does the ROI look like?
Well, the ROI, most of the people, most of the investors I talk to, I mean, at minimum, they're looking at 15 to 18% ROI. A lot of times, depending on the note, depending on whether it pays off, whether it becomes reperforming or not, they can make as much as 30 or 40% ROI on a note. Every note's individual. It depends on circumstances and the exit strategies you have to use, whether you're doing a loan modification on it or you have to eventually foreclose on it and sell the property or keep it as a rental property. There's, so the ROI can vary, but I mean, I've heard anywhere from 15, 18% at a minimum to 30, 40, maybe 50%, depending on how the deal works out in the end.
Do you have any trepidation about going to these seminars? Because I got to tell you, my experience over the years has been that when you get invited to a free seminar that's going to teach you how to make gazillions of dollars in real estate, they're typically not really worth the price of admission.
True. And that's why you have to go to a lot of them. You have to talk to other investors. That's why I think it's very important that you join a investors club, so that you're out with other investors who are experienced, whether it's in notes or buying rental properties or flipping. Having the sage advice of people who have been doing the business for years, Because like you said, you go to some of these investors expos, like I used to go to all the time when I was working with RealtyTrack, and they're talking about investing in apartments, they're talking about investing in mobile home parks.
Everything,
I mean, it all sounds terrific.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, I mean, you know, you can spend thousands and thousands of dollars for these things and never get involved in anything and just, you know, feel like you've been taken. So yeah, it's hard, and you have to really do your homework, and you have to feel confident in the person that you're working with that's going to pay off for you.
So what is your time frame for making your first investment in a note?
Well, I just got done putting together my self-directed IRA. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to use those retirement funds to buy some low-value notes. I'm probably going to joint venture with a couple of investors who are here in Orange County, California, where I live. And they're experienced investors who've been doing it for quite a while. And I'm probably going to do that probably in the next couple of weeks. I sit down with them and buy a note or two and see how it goes from there.
Dip your toe in. Well, you know what? We're going to check back with you in a couple of months and see how it's all working out.
Sounds good.
All right. Joel is a freelance real estate writer, blogger, and investor in notes and in real estate. Joel, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Elise. Appreciate it.
So I've talked a lot lately about alternative credit scoring models, mostly because otherwise qualified buyers are being frozen out of the housing market. Thin credit histories are just not really working well with the major credit reporting bureaus, not to mention the super strict lending standards that we're currently seeing for mortgages, although there is some pressure in Washington, D.C. to calm that down. Not a lot is changing for people who are on the fringes, who don't fit right into those boxes that the GSEs really want you to be in. So I'm going to continue that conversation today with my guest and really good friend, Steve Ely. Steve is the CEO at eCredible, which, just to be perfectly open and transparent about it, I sit on a board of advisors for them. I've been an investor in this company. That's a credit reporting agency, a CRA, that uses alternative data like bill payments to help consumers build their credit histories. And their marketplace also has different loan companies that will help you get an auto loan, help you get a mortgage. They just added a new one. We'll find out all about that and more. Steve, welcome back to Big Money Real Estate.
Hey, Elise, thanks. It's great to see you again.
It's great to see you. So the number of unbanked and underbanked consumers is estimated at nearly 70 million, more than a quarter of U.S. households. What's your take on whether those consumers are going to be able to jump into what we would call the mainstream financial markets?
Well, a certain number of them will be able to. The way that we look at the marketplace, we kind of look at that whole underserved, underbanked market and kind of put them in two different categories. You have to think like a creditor for a minute, and creditor looks at those people as people that have no credit history whatsoever, so they're a little bit invisible when it comes to applying a credit scoring model, traditional credit scoring model, to that kind of consumer. And then you have people that just have a little bit of credit, but it's really not enough to generate a meaningful credit score to make a credit decision from. And the problem those people have, as you probably know, is if you go online and apply for any kind of credit, the online system is very likely going to rely very heavily on your credit score to make that decision. So that's going to prohibit a lot of those people from participating in the mainstream financial system.
All right. So what is eCredible doing, just to remind all of our viewers, to kind of fill that gap?
Yeah, so there's this concept of alternative data, which leads to alternative credit. And that's what we do. We're a credit bureau, just like Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion. But the difference is we focus exclusively on the consumer. And so the consumer will come to eCredible, and we'll work with them to understand who are they making all their regular bill payments to, for bills like rent, utilities, and insurance. We verify the information on behalf of the consumer. We look at the prior 24 months of payment history. We create a credit report. We apply our credit score to it. And that allows us to connect that consumer to a lender that uses our credit score as part of their underwriting process. That effectively means that consumer doesn't have to have a traditional credit history in order to be approved for credit products necessarily. It would certainly be easier. There'd be more selection available to the consumer, but it's not a minimum requirement any longer.
You know, what I'm seeing online now are lots of startups using social media profiles and other publicly available information to help companies assess credit risk for people and even for businesses who either don't have a credit history, have a thin credit file. Companies are even using Yelp reviews for small business applicants or LinkedIn for students graduating with a lot of debt. I saw that written actually in USA Today. The companies are using rental data, and I know that eCredible is using utilities. Let's talk through and start with the social media stuff, because I think that's really interesting, but I can't think that that's a viable business model for anybody or who's trying to qualify people to get mortgages with GSEs. So are we going to see social media be the next step for people who don't have credit histories to kind of get credit histories?
So I think you'll see variations of it. One of the challenges that a lender in the United States has is that you have to meet regulatory requirements that are typically state by state. Some are federal, but most are state by state. And so when you do that, you have to deal with regulators who are monitoring exactly how you set up your lending criteria. Well, if you go to a regulator and say, we made lending decisions based upon somebody's social media status, I think you'd be in hot water. I don't know of any regulator today that would sign up for allowing anyone to use that kind of data to make a risk decision. And so what you see happening with social media is not people using it for risk decisioning per se, making a credit decision, but rather using it for marketing. In other words, could I use social media as a way to filter out certain people that probably aren't going to meet my credit underwriting criteria, and then use other data when I find that consumer to make a credit decision, traditional data, for example, that might be available about that consumer. So I think that's what you'll see for the foreseeable future, is a little bit of a hybrid in the marketplace that's a mix between marketing, let's find that consumer, and then traditional data to underwrite risk for the consumer.
So if we're not going to use social media anytime soon, let's talk about some of the sources of alternative data that we are able to use and that eCredible is using. I know that you use public records, rental data, payday information, utilities and telecom information, employment, banking information. What else, how does that all factor into what you're doing versus what, you know, Experian, Equifax and TransUnion are doing?
Yeah, so the concept of alternative data is a pretty broad concept. But generally speaking, people would describe alternative data as any data that is not typically reported to the national credit bureaus. And so typically is a strong word because the bureaus are all a little bit different. For example, Experian and TransUnion, they have rental payment data in their files. So they're able to use that as part of their decisioning process. Equifax has utility data in a file of theirs that they're not using as part of a traditional credit score, but as an alternative credit score in conjunction they're doing and work that they're doing with FICO and with LexisNexis. And so what eCredible focuses on is information that we can actually verify easily to prove the consumer's creditworthy. And so we use rent, utilities, insurance, we can use childcare, alimony, remittances, anything that the consumer can say to us, hey, here's a company that I'm making a regular payment to, and we can contact that company on behalf of the consumer and verify that payment history, because that's the way that our model works. Our model typically evolves around information that's not sitting in a national database, so you just can't go get it with a click of a button. Someone has to do some manual labor to go get the information, and that's what we do on behalf of the consumer. And so if you look at this other alternative data that LexisNexis, Equifax, the other bureaus are actually using today, they're kind of dabbling in different sources of information that allow them to complement their traditional credit scores. You know, today there is almost nobody that's storing this kind of alternative data in the core credit file, which would affect the consumer's FICO score, their classic FICO score, whether that's FICO 8 or FICO 9 or even a Vantage score. And so over time that may come to pass, but today nobody's able to do that. These are different data sets. And so what's the problem for the consumer that creates? Is that you as a consumer, if you go to Equifax.com and try to get your credit report, you're not going to see this other information in your credit file. It's going to be kept in separate databases. So the consumer is at a slight disadvantage there because the system is not as transparent as consumers would like it to be.
So when you're thinking about how it's all going to work for eCredible and consumers, first of all, we should say that eCredible has free accounts. You literally can go in, sign in, and enter in, self-report all of your payments, and there's no cost until you go to get something verified. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. We're a completely free model until the point in time when the consumer wants to apply for credit, and then they give us permission to do the verification work for them so they can go apply for the credit.
And how many different companies are in the eCredible marketplace, for example?
Yeah, we have an online marketplace today with about a dozen companies in there, but most of them are pretty small. What we're doing is working on adding some bigger national brands so the consumer has more choice. But we do have a couple of really good mortgage companies in there. One of them is a company that we've had a long time called Churchill Mortgage. And a consumer can use our credit score to go apply for a home loan at Churchill Mortgage. A recent addition to our marketplace is a new partnership with a mortgage broker out on the West Coast called South Pacific Financial Corporation. And South Pacific will use our credit report and credit score to allow a consumer to apply for an FHA home loan. And so that means a consumer without any credit history whatsoever could come to eCredible and earn the appropriate credit score in our system. We call it a credit rating. We rate people on a scale of A through F. So anyone that earns an A could go to South Pacific Financial Corporation and apply for an FHA home loan.
Which would be just great, because then you'd actually be able to go buy a house as opposed to not buying a house.
Exactly.
Steve, thanks so much. Any final thoughts on how you think this will all shake out with alternate data?
Yeah, I think it's going to get bigger and bigger, because what's happening now is that more and more large institutions are doing pilots with this kind of data. You know, 5 years ago, people were just kind of looking at it, but now people are actually doing some real work with it. So I think over the next 5 years, you'll see this kind of information go mainstream with a lot of the largest financial institutions in the country, and that'll provide more choice for consumers and allow more consumers to participate in the mainstream financial system and, frankly, avoid some of the alternative financial providers like payday lenders.
Which is really great. Steve Ely is the CEO at eCredible.com. If you want more information or you want to sign up for a free account, you can go to eCredible.com today. Hey, thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Elise. See you later.
See you later. So today I've got an update from Nino Cicinava. I hope I'm saying that right. The principal economist for home remodeling and design platform Houzz. They have just released the Houzz renovation barometer for the first quarter of 2015. So these are great numbers to be getting. Nino, welcome back to Big Money Real Estate.
Great to be back, Elise.
So what is the barometer showing about home remodeling so far this year? I mean, we've had a lousy first quarter in terms of weather, but a lot of the remodeling that goes on is interior. So what are you seeing?
The Houzz renovation barometer tracks fluctuations in the home renovation market. We're seeing an uptick in professional confidence for improvement in the market. We're seeing an improvement in Q1 in the number of new inquiries, number of new projects, and the size of new projects. Oh. So these are the quarter over quarter gains in Q1 are very good. And we're also seeing a continued year over year improvement.
So I noticed in the data that you're seeing landscape and outdoor specialties. There's gains for architects, general contractors, and design build firms. Where do you see the most gain come from? Landscape and outdoor areas?
Usually the landscape and outdoor projects happen in the spring. So it is not surprising that the confidence amongst the landscape and outdoor specialties is especially high. But that the spring also marks the beginning of the construction season. So the fact that the general contractors are reporting widespread increases in their new business activity is a very good sign.
So when you guys look at the data, you know, what people are posting on Houzz or what they're looking at on Houzz, you know, what kinds of interesting projects are you seeing? Or is this just sort of, you know, time to get to the garden, time to, you know, regrade, or we're adding an addition? Where exactly do you think the growth is going to come from this year?
I think the growth will vary significantly across regions. In the Northeast, we're hearing a lot of replacement projects being put in place mm-hmm. because of the record winter conditions, you know, very high snowfall. There's going to be a lot of siding, exterior features replacements, a lot of roof replacement. In the South and in the West, there's continued improvement to the outdoor spaces, and the discretionary spending is up. We're seeing an improvement in the kitchens and bathrooms, and those are sort of the most popular of the interior spaces, and we're going to see an uptick in those spaces in the house.
That's really nice. What do you think people are going to be choosing as far as finishes go? I mean, are we leaving the era of granite and marble behind yet?
You know, marble in the bathrooms is still very trendy. So I don't think we're going to get away from that. Granite is at its highest continuously. in the kitchens. So no, I think that because these spaces are expensive, because the remodels there are not very frequent, consumers continue to focus on more traditional materials, materials that tend to be more durable.
So you think that projects are going to continue, renovation projects are going to continue to increase in the second quarter, and that people are feeling really engaged and optimistic about that. What about the budgets? Do you think the budgets are going to be rising, or are we going to see a continued kind of main flatline for that?
We are seeing that the professionals are reporting year-to-year improvement in the size of the new projects and orders, and that is indicative of the budgets increasing. As well as the quarter-over-quarter, in Q2, the home renovation market kicks into gear more so than in Q1, and so we are seeing very high optimism for the size of the projects to improve.
So people are spending more money and more projects are underway. That's really good news for the renovation market. Nino Cicinava is the principal economist at House. Hey, thank you so much for our update.
Thank you very much, Elise.
Well, today's show, I've got Michael Slavin. He's the founder and CEO of Privlo. This is another private money lender, but their target consumer is the average home buyer who can't get a bank to lend the money. Maybe they've got a thin file, maybe they're self-employed, maybe they've just opened up for business here in the state of Illinois. Hey, Michael, welcome to Big Money Real Estate.
Thank you.
It's nice to have you. Who does Privlo, let's start with, tell us a little bit about Privlo, who you cater to, and why you started this company.
Sure. So Privlo is a company. We're categorized as a marketplace lender. So it's this new breed of lenders, ones that I think the consumers would be more familiar with. They are familiar groups like Lending Club that are focused on personal loans, On Debt Capital focused on small business loans, and Privlo is focused actually on residential home loans. So we're a marketplace lender, meaning that we're taking private capital and we're putting it to work using data science to really serve an underserved borrower niche that's not typically addressed by typical bank underwriting models.
Why is it so hard for self-employed people to get loans today?
So for this particular group, essentially, they have, let's say, more opaque income than typical individuals. They're not just a W-2 employee with a straightforward income on an annual basis. They might take deductions for tax purposes. They might have spiky income because they have a seasonally driven business. In Chicago, for instance, like somebody who owns a snow removal business, they have some big months, especially the last couple of years, and then they have some slow months when there's no snow falling.
All right. So one of the things that used to happen is you would have stated income loans with regular banks. They would, for a higher interest rate, allow you to just say whatever it was you thought you earned, and they wouldn't require any documentation. Now that's gone away with the housing crisis. And it sounds to me like Privlo has kind of stepped into that space to try and make loans to these people who would otherwise have maybe gotten a loan from a big bank using a stated income loan.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. And we do extend that program, but we're taking the next step. So what's happening behind the scenes in the, I'd say the credit officer that we've hired and the specialists we have in-house, we've taken a new approach in mortgage, where actually our credit people all come from the consumer lending world. So they're really good at analyzing consumer and their bank statements over time. So not only do we want to hear what a borrower makes per month, we're actually going to verify that income through third-party sources. So essentially deposits into their bank account month over month to make sure that we can, we can verify that they're actually making the money they're stating that they're making, which did not happen during the crisis.
Right. So one of the things that's pretty interesting is when over the last week, I was at a journalism conference, and it used to be that all of these business journalists worked for Bloomberg or the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, Market Watch, and now half the people in the audience have lost their jobs and they're working on their own. They're maybe making almost as much as they were before, but to your point, they're independent. And independent workers overall in the U.S. grew to almost 18 million last year. That was up 12.5% over the previous year. So Privlo, which in doing the research for the show, we found began as a peer-to-peer lender. Now you're more a direct lender or a retail lender, as we would call it. Is it your belief that after the 2008 crisis and all of these different people lost their jobs and are now kind of figuring it out as we're coming out of this great recession, they've got income, but they just don't qualify? Is this just so underserved that traditional lenders are hamstrung and they just can't get to these people?
Sure, sure. So it's pretty interesting. There's a couple of things happening, or a few market forces. One is, you're right, where the 2008 downturn actually resulted in a lot of folks being laid off. And what's happened is corporations have become profitable again, but they learned from lessons from the past. They want to be able to right size their workforce quickly. And so if you bring on contractors, you can size up a workforce, but you can also size it down very, very quickly without all the ramifications of traditional employees. And so that's one factor taking place. Also, what you have is a big shift in professionals. So architects, accountants, attorneys, et cetera, we're seeing a lot of conversion actually over to a contract basis for tax purposes typically. So they can actually take deductions and work on their own and really call their own schedule. And we're also seeing that to a further extent. We're going to see that in coming years with the millennials. Millennials like a more flexible work schedule, also fueled by the on-demand economy, which you see in companies like Uber and other companies where essentially a consumer can click a button on a mobile phone and get services, whether it's TaskRabbit, somebody to deliver your mail, shovel the snow on your walk, or Uber whenever you need a ride. So we're seeing all these demographic shifts take place currently, and we're happy to address them. They also result in very uneven income or very unpredictable income by bank standards.
Right, of course they do. So when you are, where do you see this business growing? I know you're in a dozen markets and you're doing a lot here in Illinois. Where do you see the demand coming from, and how big do you think this is going to get over the next 2 years?
Sure. It's because of the growth story we just talked about a moment ago, it's by some accounts, I know Forbes magazine feels that what over 29% of the workforce in today's world and over 50% by 2019 will actually have some component of self-employment or some component of additional income through non-traditional sources. And so as far as region, what we're doing in our strategy is essentially if you stick to the coasts, you'll get the most is the term in lending or any business for that matter. And you can imagine that 70% of the population around the world lives along the coast. So the states that we're going to hit hard, or we have hit hard at the beginning, are coastal states, and we move inland. There are a few exceptions like Texas, which is a great growth story for tax treatment purposes and baby boomers actually retiring to a warm state. But other than that, we're really focused on the coast, and then we'll move inland in the next 2 years.
Okay, and Illinois is a perfect place for this. Chicago, well, the state of Illinois is, or I should say the city of Chicago, I learned this past week at this journalism conference from Mayor Emanuel, Chicago is number 4 of the 75 largest cities in the world for tech businesses and technology, which is really astonishing. So to your point, new businesses and startups are rapidly expanding here. Your perspective is that more of those people won't be able to qualify for traditional loans, at least not in the next few years. I just want to get back to sort of costs. How are you guys making this work? How much money have you raised for it? And I understand you also retain a portion of ownership on every loan made. Why don't you quickly describe those, please?
Sure. So it is a really, I think, challenging situation to actually underwrite these borrowers effectively at scale. That's why we do have consumer credit scientists in mass that we've actually hired onto the company. So we can digest financials quickly, and all this has been completely automated, which is a terribly challenging problem. And that's why you're not seeing this happen from traditional industry, because it takes a lot of forward investment. And to be able to do that, you need to go out to venture capitalists and convince them that you have an idea that's worth the merit of actually building the technology around, and that you'll have returns on that investment down the road. And so we've been lucky enough to get some of the best venture capitalists in the world who focus on fintech, which our category is called, to invest in our platform. And so we've actually raised over $10 million to date and are currently focused on a new round as we speak. And that money, of course, translates into automated technology so we can ingest bank statements quickly, seamlessly, actually analyze credit behaviors of consumers over time, which nobody else is doing in the industry. So again, it's a really daunting challenge. It's a lot of fun. And we're happy to be on top of it every single day, extending this technology to consumers to make a better consumer experience and to reduce transaction friction, meaning they don't have to put as much work in. We do all the hard thinking to get to a yes quickly.
But who's underwriting the paper? So if you're using the $10 million for technology, who's actually underwriting the paper, and where are you reselling that loan?
Sure. So as far as who underwrites, it's pretty interesting. You look at the human brain. In the processing capacity we still hold, it outruns a computer every single day of the week. I mean, we're just so complex as creatures, and our thought processes are so lightning quick. But what you can do is augment that human thought process with technology. So it's essentially letting computers do what they do best and the human do what they do best. And so there are certain red flags that come up in any particular transaction that could, you know, raise a red flag for, say, money laundering, for instance. And a human's going to be able to pick that up, but not typically a computer. So we actually, it's a dual underwrite, if you call it that, where we have an automated process, a human quickly checks the process, and we actually sell the loans on a one-by-one basis to private investors. And what happens at that stage, we actually retain a portion of the ownership or income stream of every loan. And when the loans go to, say, a securitization or they're held on a balance sheet, we'll retain a portion of ownership, either through an equity stake or an equity stake in any case.
So who is the servicer for these loans?
And so we're actually the servicer of record, but we have a subservicer that's in place. And those subservicers are typically investor-driven, meaning that the hedge funds we work with want a certain servicer they've worked with in the past. And so we have a few servicers we work with.
And what are the costs to consumers typically? What interest rates are you offering?
That's a great question. So in this industry, it's somewhat of a new space where before we got involved at scale, you had, say, traditional loan rates, which everybody's pretty aware of. You can check those on bankrate.com on a daily basis. They hover around, let's say, 3.5% to 4% in today's world. And then on the other end of the spectrum, before we entered this scene, you had hard money lenders that would start at typically 9% and up. And so our range today that we're hitting is we have a 5.25% start rate, and we go up to just below 10%. Even though we never get to 10%, those are pretty extreme cases. It's really hard for people to actually have that bad a credit, and usually it's a pretty risky credit.
So you are you pulling FICO scores, but because people don't have the 2 years of self-employment data like P&Ls and actual tax returns, they don't qualify for regular loans, so you're actually qualifying them based on a FICO score?
FICO score helps triangulate and actually price risk, and we go much further beyond just a FICO score. Where that works a lot for, say, credit card issuance in much smaller dollar transactions, we're actually interested in the entire credit history of an individual. So we really lend upon a spectrum of borrowers. On one end, it's just, you know, say a borrower has a really good FICO score who just has really uneven income or really opaque income, like a business owner, because they take a lot of deductions for tax purposes. And so it's not so FICO score driven on that end of the spectrum. On the other end of the spectrum, who we do serve, who does have a damaged FICO, is, say, a borrower who had a one-time bad life event. That could be a medical bankruptcy, foreclosure, short sale, et cetera. So essentially, you look at their credit history over time, they're really good credit, they're always paying their bills on time, but they had one life event that really resulted in some bad circumstances. So they lost their job or they went through a divorce. And so we're able to isolate those events and say, okay, this person's been a great credit for the last 20 years, but they had a really tough year that was outside of their control. And so that's where we're able to actually right size the loan for them and price the risk appropriately and still give them a competitive rate.
It's terrific. Well, we really appreciate your time today, Michael. Michael Slavin is the founder and CEO of Privlo. We'll check back in with you in 6 months or so and see how it's going.
That sounds great. We're excited to get to Illinois.
All right. Not too long ago, I got a question from a 20-something first-time investor about leveraging debt versus building equity in real estate. He asked whether I would recommend reaching a specific level of equity in a rental unit before purchasing another property. So here's what I'm thinking. When I look at debt versus equity, I'm always choosing, when it comes to investing in real estate, to get a bigger mortgage, especially when interest rates are historically low like they are now, on the investment properties I own with my husband and my friend, so that we could write off the expense of the interest against the income the property generates. So that's me. We purchased an investment condo, for example, with an interest-only loan. We put 20% down, plus we paid another chunk for upgrades. When we bought it from the blueprints, I can't even believe this, it might be even 7 to 10 years ago. It's hard to remember. It might be 10 years ago we bought it, and then 7 years ago we closed on it. We had an adjustable rate mortgage on that property, and we've managed to stay cash positive for basically the whole time up until this last rate, you know, increase. Today, it's been tough to purchase investment property with less than 25 to 35% in cash. And once you own 4 residential properties, including your primary residence, you may find it difficult to get any sort of financing for an investment property through Freddie Mac or Fannie Mae, even though you used to be able to get up to 10 properties total. And today that's just really hard to do. Building a portfolio of rental properties or other types of investment real estate means making connections with several commercial lenders who will be able to guide you on what kind of equity they want to see in order to provide financing. And you want to find somebody who really specializes in the kind of property you're buying. So if you're buying strip malls, find a strip mall lender. I just heard today from a guy who's at SunTrust. He just moved to SunTrust. And I asked him what he's looking for, and he said he's looking to provide financing $10 to $50 million. You go to him with a $5 million property loan, he's not going to be interested. He's looking at $10 to $50 million. So there's hyper-specialization going on as well. So some lenders are going to require that you put down 35% in cash for deals 2, 3, or 4, or any commercial. But by the time you own a half a dozen properties, particularly if each has a significant number of units, and by significant I mean usually more than 3 or 4, you may be able to refinance all of the properties together with a single loan. And there's pluses and minuses to that strategy, so you're going to want to think it through. Keep in mind that the amount of debt you carry on your investment properties must be repaid. This is not like you buy it and never pay it back. So the rental income that you have needs to be considered, right? And how stable those rents are. Your federal income tax situation, other details relating to the number of properties that you might want to buy in the future, in making your decision. This is all going to be key to making the decision, the smart decision about how much debt to carry relative to the equity over the long run. Because there are always going to be hard money lenders, also known as private money lenders, and we've had some of those interviews, who will be willing to do a zero, what would effectively be a zero down on these properties. That is really risky, and tread with caution. The best piece of advice I can offer is to not do all this on your own. So sit down with a bunch of different lenders so that they can walk you through the different scenarios that could affect this decision of how many properties to buy, where to buy them, how much debt to carry. You should definitely build a group of trusted advisors who will help you create your own real estate investment portfolio and the strategy behind it. Strategy is key for whatever you're going to be doing. And if you take the right steps and you continue to make this a central goal, I have no doubt you're going to get where you want to go. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. I want to give a big thank you to all of our guests, including some of the people who are sending questions, and I'm able to answer those. If there's anything you missed, don't worry. You can find the show notes to this episode at thinklink.com. ThinkLink is my website, thinklink.com. Also, if you're new to the show, be sure to subscribe to the podcast. If you're a regular listener and haven't done so, please consider giving this show a rating and or a review in iTunes. And you can do that by searching for the Elise Glink Show in the podcast section. This helps the show get discovered by new people. I would also personally love it if you subscribe to the YouTube channel. You can also watch these episodes online and see the people that I'm talking to at youtube.com/expertrealestatetips. All right, that's the end of another episode of the Elise Glink Show. I'm still your host, Elise Glink, and guess what? I'll be back next week with a new episode. Thanks so much for listening, and have a great week.